Good morning, everyone. Being the first speaker, I would like to welcome you all and thank CEPS for the opportunity to be here and present this work. So this is a joint work with a few colleagues at the IMF, at the European Department, and it's part of, if you want, fund-wide effort to look into further into these issues of the participation of women in economic activity, labor market, and other. And as mentioned this morning, try to see the extent to which the participation or lack of it influences growth drivers across the membership. So this work will be part of a forthcoming book which collects this work, not only for Europe, but across the membership. And so this work is, in fact, what I'll present today is a collection of two papers, one that looks at the drivers of female participation in labor markets in Europe, and the other one that looks at one particular aspect of the costs of the lack of participation in certain aspects. In particular, the underrepresentation of women in senior positions at the firm level, at the non-financial corporate world. So as you know, if you look over the last three decades, you'll see that millions of women have joined the labor force, and that's a positive thing. However, progress has been uneven across countries, and there are still important gaps, as I'm about to show you. So the first leg of this work is to ask what shapes women's decision to join or not join the labor market, and can policies have an important role in these decisions? Now, this is not a new question, but as I'll try to convince you, we try to shed light on this question using a different or novel empirical approach. And we believe we have, although we arrived to the same answer as colleagues who have worked on this issue, we provide new insight into it. The second part of the work is to look at how the underrepresentation of women in leadership roles, so in the upper ranks of the corporate workforce, is creating is generating economic loss, right? So to what extent are we losing, is there an opportunity cost of women not being represented more strongly? I don't know, how do I? Thank you. So the overarching motivation for this work is this well-known fact that growth prospects in Europe are waning for the decades to come. The strongest driver of this reduction in growth potential comes from the aging in populations. So we have here in the chart the expected evolution of old age dependency ratios, and we see that as the share of working population declines over time, these old age dependency ratios, so the share of retired people to those in the active in the labor force, is expected to rise very steeply from levels under 60% currently to about 75% on average and close to 90% in some regions of Europe, notably Southern Europe. Now, this has a direct bearing on potential growth. If you look, this chart comes from our World Economic Outlook of about a year and a half ago. A chapter on this in this publication has looked at the prospects for growth in Europe and has decomposed potential growth drivers through the accumulation of capital, labor input, and TFP, so total factor productivity. And we see indeed the red bars show us the evolution of labor input, and that's where we see the impact, the negative impact on growth of this aging population. So we expect less and less employment growth going forward. Here the chart shows only to 2020, but the trends persist in the following decades in the major countries in Europe. But also importantly, if you would look at the yellow bar showing us expected evolution of productivity, so total factor productivity, we also see that compared to pre-crisis years, there's a moderation is expected and is expected to continue declining again beyond 2020. Now, adding to these concerns, or, you know, as a side aspect, is that we still see, as of today, despite tremendous progress, as I mentioned, gaps in the participation of women in the labor force. So women still are less active, and when they are or where they are most active, or in certain countries, they do so by participating only part-time. So they work considerably less number of hours than men. So the question, the overarching question we ask is, can women help? Would address those participation gaps help mitigate to some, I wouldn't say eliminate, but mitigate to a certain extent the projected decline in potential growth in Europe? And there is one very direct channel through which this might happen, which is if we have a more intense participation of women in the labor force, either through being active in the labor market or being active more fully, meaning in full-time jobs, then just as a direct impact, the growth in employment would increase. So we'd have more employment and therefore more output. But there might be an additional channel, and this is one that has attracted a lot of interest from the literature lately, which is, could it be that a broader presence of women in the labor force, and in particular in management roles in the corporate world, would also help mitigate the decline in TFP? So could we see that there's a role for women's participation in these boards or in senior management to stem productivity at a broader level? So with this in mind, we ask two questions. Why is labor force participation in Europe not higher? And as I mentioned, what's the role of policies? And could we have a boost in productivity? So if we look, so as I said, these are the two legs of our work. The way we see it all hanging together is that policies, as well as personal characteristics, have a bearing on women's choice as to they want to participate or not, and they want to participate in full or part-time. What type of policies? Well, most prominently, taxation policies, as I will explain in a minute, and family-friendly policies. The extent to which women choose to participate in the labor market then shapes what is the supply, what is the pool of talent from which can be drawn for women to be present in leadership roles. And perhaps we will see whether yes or no, if we have a larger supply of women, then that might have a bearing on financial performance. And to the extent that larger financial performance is associated with higher productivity and raises opportunity for investment at the corporate level, and as I said, directly through a labor supply channel, then that would mean that policies do have an ultimate bearing through these various channels on GDP. So as I mentioned, over the last few decades, so in this chart shows us on the left for the advanced Europe, on the right for the emerging Europe, what has been the evolution of participation rates by women in the labor market. And we see that particularly in the advanced Europe, there has been tremendous progress in bringing women into the labor force. So, for example, if you would look at Spain, that's the green line, or Ireland, which I don't think it's in their chart, you'd see that participation rates have risen from less than 40 in the 80s to now close to 80%. However, so you see that, one, progress is uneven across countries. Second, the status as of now is also different across countries. We still see important differences in participation rates across Europe. So, for example, Italy and Malta still have very low participation rates, in the order of 60%, contrasting, for example, with the Nordic countries, where participation rates have been traditionally larger, or across emerging Europe, where also participation rates have been very high. So you don't see a lot of progress there. You still see a lot of cross-country variation, but you don't see a lot of progress there because traditionally there has been a more active participation by women in the labor market. Now, what does this progress chart hide? Is that, as I mentioned, first, the progress is uneven and there's still a lot of cross-country variation. So, for example, when we look at participation gaps between men and women, we see that there's a huge difference between a country, for example, that I was just mentioning, like Malta or Italy, if I'm looking at the left-hand side chart, or the Nordic countries and Eastern European countries, where the gaps between male and female participation in the labor market are smaller. Still, you know, so gaps are still important in many countries despite progress. And more importantly, and now let's shift to the chart in the right-hand side, there is an important gap in hours worked between men and women, so much larger than the gaps in participation. And this particular gap on average hour work has actually not changed a lot over the recent years, which is a different way of saying that a lot of the progress we see in the increase rising participation has come about through a part-time attachment of women to the labor force. Now, of course, part-time work or part-time attachment to the labor force per se is not a bad thing. It's a positive thing that through a change in legislative systems or through tax incentives in many European countries, it has been possible to attract more and more women into the labor market and help them conciliate perhaps family obligations with market work through this part-time attachment. What would be a source of inefficiency and loss of welfare is if the current systems, the current policies, are also constraining in the sense that, yes, they allow for some participation, but not to a full participation in the labor market when women do wish to do so. So, looking at another aspect of women's participation in economic activity, what happens in corporate boards? So, as you may know, I'm presumably living here in Brussels, there has been a movement for introducing quotas for female participation in boards, in corporate boards, in publicly listed companies. So the first country to introduce this, to the best of our knowledge, was Norway in 2003. Many other countries follow suit. The last one, Germany, also introducing a quota. And the European Commission has called upon publicly listed companies to make this commitment of increasing female participation in their corporate boards. I think to a 30% quota by 2015, but a larger quota, 40% by 2020. And we do see that, so that's the left-hand side chart showing changes in female participation in boards. The red bars show us the countries where gender quotas were introduced, and we do see some effect of this quota introduction in the representation of women in boards. Nevertheless, we're still very far from parity. So if you would look at the right-hand chart where you see the share of women and men in corporate boards of the 600 largest publicly listed companies in Europe, you see that we're still below 20% on average representation of women, with a lot of cross-country variation again. If we would show you a chart in which we look at the share of women among top executives, the number would be even lower, closer to 10%. Now, in our study, we didn't want to restrain ourselves only to the publicly listed companies, not least because they are not necessarily employing the largest share of population in Europe. So we make use of a very large corporate data set, Orbis, which has about 4 million firms, out of which we can use data on about 2 million firms. But this includes large companies, medium-sized companies, and small companies as well. So these charts I'm showing you here use this data. So look at the broader spectrum of companies. And look as well not only at corporate boards, but also the share of women in senior management. So it's a little bit broader. And what we see there is, if you would look at the green bars on the left-hand side, that the representation of women among these companies and among, you know, senior management is a bit higher. So it's on average about a quarter, which is higher than 20%. However, if we compare, and again, there's a huge variation across countries. If you would compare in Austria, you have a representation of less than 10%, whereas in Ukraine, we have it close to 50%. But again, if you would compare the yellow dots, which show female participation rate, so the share of women in the labor force, which is close to 50 in many countries, vis-a-vis the green bars, which is the representation in senior management, we still see a huge gap. So there's a far more important representation of women in the labor force than in senior management. So that speaks to a poor correlation between women's participation in the labor force and women's representativity in senior management. And why is that? This question is not the main focus of our study, but we still wanted to look at it. And we have found, or we found tentative evidence that, in fact, instead of a strong association between overall participation and share of women in top positions, we find that there's a very strong association between the incidence of part-time work among women and the share of women in leadership roles. And this is no surprise. I mean, part-time work rarely lends itself to very steep career progress or to being in leadership roles. So that means this. What would this imply is that if we want to ask the question, why are women so underrepresented, there's at least some role to supply side considerations, meaning perhaps they are underrepresented because the pool of talent from which to draw to choose women for leadership positions is much narrower than a simple participation share would suggest. Now, does this necessarily mean that more women in leadership roles would be better? That's the question we try to answer. And if we look at the literature, the jury is still out as to whether or not this is the case. Seminal work by McKinsey and Catalyst have shown that that's the case. So they find a strong association between the share of women in leadership, so in corporate boards, and profitability. But more recent papers which try to address causality issues a bit more seriously find inconclusive results. Some don't find any impact, some even find a negative impact. Now, one common feature of most of these studies is, one, a very narrow data set, because they look only at publicly listed companies, and more often than not, only a single country. So those are issues that we'll try to address. So again, how do we go about the empirical work? This is again, the first part of the work, which tries to answer the question, what drives women's choices? And the novelty of our work is to use a micro study, which includes this family and changing gender roles module of the ISSP, so the International Social Survey Program. What this survey tries to do is gauge, for a broad sample coverage, attitudes of households and women towards the presence of women in the labor market. So questions such as, do you believe that women should participate in income generation for the family? Do you think that the well-being of children is harmed by women's participation in the labor force? Do you think that family life is harmed or not? So these questions are asked in this survey, and we extract the principal component of answers to these questions. There are about 9 questions to come up with an indicator of how positive is the attitude of this person, of this household, towards participation of women in the labor force. So we use this survey, and we try to estimate, so at the end, the probability that a woman chooses to be employed, that's the E, as a function of Z, that's its own personal characteristics. So these attitudes I just talked about, things like education, age, marriage status, etc. And importantly, X, those are policies. And by policies, we look at the taxation of secondary earners in a family, so how burdensome is the taxation of the second earner in a family vis-a-vis the first earner. And for many countries, so on average in Europe, the marginal tax rate faced by someone who's the second earner in a family, so earning about two-thirds of the average wage, is about twice the marginal tax burden of a single earner. And we try also to look at policies such as family allowances, whether targeted or not, child care provision, etc. And what we find is that, so the blue bars show us the impact. So this shows, we look at two rounds of this survey, the 2002 and 2012. We look at what's one standard deviation of change between these 2 years of each of these variables, and look at what is the impact of that one standard deviation on the probability of employment. And we do see that, for example, demographic factors such as the number of children or education have the expected bearing on decisions, on employment decisions. However, there's a very important role indeed for attitudes. And the reason why we thought, let me step back a minute, the reason why we thought that measuring these attitudes was important, and no other paper has done it, is that we often, when we talk to policymakers and talk about distortions of policy over women's employment choice, the feedback we hear is, well, you know, policies in my country reflect the preferences. So it's not that the policies have a bearing on women's choice. The policies are configured as such because this is our social preference for more or less female labor force participation. So we thought it was important to actually control exogenously for the role of this, of these attitudes. And we do see, I mean, if you would look at the variation across individual households, attitudes explain the most of the variation. Indeed. Still, we do find a large role for taxation and benefit policies. So, for example, having a large marginal tax on secondary earners discourages strongly employment. On the other hand, the same goes for example, untargeted family allowances, which go for everybody, no matter what income or work status. By an income effect, they discourage participation in the labor market. On the other hand, the provision of childcare, for example, to the extent that it's complementary to work, as expected, increases the participation of women. If I may be allowed to extend just for 2 minutes, I'll just say an extra sentence here. Two nuances on this chart. First, there are important differences between Eastern and advanced Europe. And on that, I'll just say, for example, taxation policies are far more important in advanced Europe than in emerging Europe. On the contrary, the degree of childcare provision is far more important in emerging Europe than in advanced Europe. This might just have to do with the fact that, you know, there's more variation of taxation policies in advanced world, and there's, in a say, on average, less provision of childcare in emerging Europe, which means that the marginal impact of increasing that provision would be larger. But this is something we find. The other thing we find is that this is about participation, the extensive margin. If you would do a similar exercise looking at the intensive margin, you would see that, one, some of the variables, the demographic variables here, have a different bearing. So, for example, whether or not one is married doesn't have a very important bearing on the choice to be employed, but does affect a lot the extent to which the person works part-time or full-time, for example. Education. Education has a lot of bearing on the choice to be employed, but has no bearing at all on the choice to be employed full-time or part-time. As to policies, taxation is important both at the extensive and intensive margin. But, for example, we find that the provision of childcare has more of a bearing on the choice to be in the labor market than how far to be. So, very quickly, I'll go through the second part of the work, looking at, again, looking at the broad set of policies. Is it true that having more women in senior management implies more profitability? So if we regress Y, which is the profitability, on the share of women in boards, that's this SH variable, and number of controls for the firm, size, assets, age of the firm, size of the board, so on and so forth. And we do find We use three different variables to measure profitability, all as a share of total assets, net income, profit before tax, and earnings before interest and tax. And we do find that the impact of having one more woman at the board or replacing one man by one woman, so keeping the board size constant, is statistically positive. And it ranges between 8 and 13% of the return on assets. So this is a 3 to 8% increase in return on assets on average. Now, a lot of people might say, well, but this is a correlation, right? The share of women in boards and profitability of the firm is jointly determined by a number of reasons. So it may be that more profitable firms, for example, are able to attract more women into their boards. We don't think we fully resolved this issue, but we tried to, through a difference in difference estimation, shed some light into this question. And basically, we posed the following hypothesis. Well, if the correlation goes from presence of women to profitability, then we should see two things. First, that it's likely that the impact is larger in sectors where more women are represented in the labor force. And that's because one would expect that the benefit of having women in leadership roles increases if they are managing a pool of workers where a lot of women are also represented. So women might be more welcoming to family-friendly policies. They may work as a role model for workers in a firm, and so on and so forth. So we do the same exercise we did before, but separating by sectors, which have very different degrees of representation of women in the workforce. Furthermore, why would women, the presence of women in boards, be rendered the firm more profitable? Well, so culturally, you know, most of the psychology literature would say that's because probably, if you have more diversity in the board, including along gender lines, but also other lines, that means that you would have a broader spectrum of views as to the management and decision making. You would have complementarity in skills. And probably there's just a more fruitful environment for creative thinking. So we also should see that in high-tech industries where there's more demand for knowledge complementarity than creative thinking, the impact of women in the board should be larger. And we do find evidence for both these theories. So this is the last slide I'm showing. On the left-hand side, we look at how our results, so the impact of having one more woman in the board in profitability, that's the yellow diamond, changes by sector. And we see that in sectors where women are largely represented in the labor force, so that's the bar, and where there's a higher wedge between representativity in the board and representativity in the workforce, that's the blue part of the bar, so such as the services sector, the impact of having one more woman in the board on the return on assets is way larger, so in the order of 30%, than, for example, in construction, where one, women are less represented in the workforce and there's less of a gap between representativity in leadership and in the workforce. In fact, for construction, the result is not statistically significant. Similarly, if we would split the result across high-tech industries and other industries, we also see that for non-high-tech industries, our result is not significant, whereas it is highly significant for high-tech industries. What is the main policy message then? So we found out that whether or not to work is not simply a personal choice. The personal characteristics and attitudes do have a bearing, but policies matter. And furthermore, for the reasons I just described, we find supportive evidence to the theory that more women in leadership roles can increase productivity. So this means that policies such as lowering the marginal taxation on the secondary earner or increasing the provision of childcare, as argued by many, can have an important bearing on GDP in the long term, both through a direct impact and because by fostering full-time attachment of women into the labor force, it creates the pool of talent from which to draw women which can climb to the upper rungs of the corporate ladder, thereby increasing productivity. And I'm way over my speaking time, so I'll close here.